It's a ritual on Late Night with David Letterman. First, Letterman announces his guests. Then he introduces his music director, Paul Schaefer, and the irony begins. Irony about showbiz and hipness and Schaefer's band, which he calls the world's most dangerous band. My guest, Paul Schaefer, has been Late Night's music director since the program went on the air in 1982. He was also the house pianist for four of the first 5 years of Saturday Night Live and was often featured in sketches. On The Letterman Show, many of today's top funk and rock musicians sit in with Schaefer's band, and Schaefer has performed on records by other musicians. Now he has his first record under his own name. It's called Coast to Coast, and it features many of the musicians he idolized while growing up, as well as younger musicians he's come to admire. On this track, When the Radio is On, Schaefer combines doo-wop and hip-hop. It features the rappers Ecstasy and Fresh Prince, and an all-star doo-wop chorus, which includes Dion, Johnny Maestro from The Cress, and Jay Siegel from The Tokens, as well as Carole King and Ellie Greenwich, who wrote many of the girl group hits. Schaefer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, Terry, yeah. Thank you so much, and I'm absolutely thrilled to be here because you can't get enough fresh air in this world.
Well, tell me in your own words what the concept of your record is. It's really a series of homages in a way.
Well, that's exactly what it is. It's called Coast to Coast because I went coast to coast to the different cities in the USA from where I felt rock and roll originally emanated. In other words, I went to New Orleans and I did a cut in that style, and I went to Miami and I did a Miami Sound thing, and I did a Motown thing in Detroit, and in each place collaborated with the people that, in most cases were my idols from these places, the people that I felt really helped invent this music that we now like to call rock and roll.
Now, you grew up in Thunder Bay, which is just north of Buffalo, across the Canadian border.
Actually, it is just north of Duluth, Minnesota.
Oh, really?
A little bit farther. Yeah, Toronto is across border from Buffalo.
Gee, I thought I was really near Thunder Bay when I lived in Buffalo.
Well, you know, there is a Thunder Bay, now that you're right, because there is a Thunder Bay somewhere in that area near Toronto, but it's not the Thunder Bay that I come from. My Thunder Bay is much colder and more desolate than that one.
Was it hard to pick up the radio stations that you wanted to hear?
Well, that was one of the greatest things about growing up, because there was not, let's face it, too much happening for a kid like myself up there, you know, except skiing and skating, really. Those were the only things. But after dark, the big 50,000-watt stations would beam up there across the Great Lakes, and I was able to get WLS AM radio and ABC in New York, and I could tune in on what the sound of the USA was. I mean, we had a certain number of records. Of course, you know, we had the same records up there to a degree on the local radio stations. But, for instance, you couldn't get soul music up there.
Mm-hmm.
When I first discovered KAAY, Little Rock, Arkansas, was broadcasting an all-night soul show every night from 12 midnight on, I was in soul heaven as a kid.
Well, you loved black music growing up, and you've since worked with a lot of black musicians. Were you exposed to any black people when you were growing up?
There were not too many black people up there at all.
Mm-hmm.
And now that you mention it, there was one black family that moved to town at one point, and the kid, whose name was Randy Light, had a rock and roll band. And I was friendly with him. And I think that was it, really, for the black population of Thunder Bay, Ontario.
I wanted to play a track from the new record that you sing on, and this is One Cup of Coffee. And this is a track, I think, produced by Alan Toussaint?
That is correct. When I met Alan Toussaint, or Toussaint, you know, I've known him for some years now. I still don't know how to pronounce his name.
Is it he says his family pronounces it both ways, depending which side of the family
well,
it is.
See, there you are. I hung out with him a little bit in New Orleans, and he was so nice to me down there. I'd studied him since I was small. You know, I think his record, Mother-in-Law, was one of the first rock and roll records that really turned my head around, as we say now in the 80s. And when I met him, it was like I always dreamed it would be. There we were partying together in New Orleans and going to clubs and sitting in together and stuff and making music together. And I said to myself, boy, if I could do a cut like this with Alan down here in New Orleans, and then maybe I could do something with Valerie Simpson in Detroit. And I started to conceptualize the album that way after I met Toussaint.
Mm-hmm. So you sing on this. You don't sing very much.
I don't sing on all the cuts. I sing on a couple of things. I have a lot of wonderful guest vocalists on this thing, too. But in this case, I asked Dr. John to do a duet with me on this song, and he wanted to do it. His schedule just didn't work out. And Toussaint just said, go in there and just sell it, you know, and so I did it for him. I guess I was thinking Dr. John a little bit, though, when I was trying to sing it.
Right. Well, let's hear it. This is One Cup of Coffee. My guest, Paul Schaefer, on vocals, and this is from his new album, Coast to Coast.
I guess.
Paul Schaefer from his new album, Coast to Coast. Can I ask you a few things about working on the Letterman show?
Yeah.
Had you always watched Carson growing up?
Well, absolutely, sure.
Of the band leaders, you know, Doc and Tommy, what did you really love and what did you love to hate about all the rituals surrounding them on the show?
I don't know. It was a form that I was ingrained in all of us, I guess, watching, you know, Carson night after night, and I even remember Jack Parr a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Letterman show started, there we were, you know, there I was, actually doing it. He would introduce me at the beginning of the show, just, I guess, the way Jackie Gleason used to introduce Sammy Spear, the flower of the musical world, you know, and I would take a bow, and I would say, boy, here I am, in show business. Then I realized I better start saying something when he introduces me, or I'm going to blow a golden opportunity. So when I did start to speak, when I got enough nerve to speak into my mic after he said my name, the first thing I said was like a show business kind of cliche that we had heard on these talk shows all of these years, you know. But something that somebody might have said that just, you know, I said, David, you are marvelous. You know, it's so marvelous to be here with you. And he just cracked up. And I kind of went with that for a while, spouting all the show business cliches that I'd ever laughed at in all my years of watching these TV shows.
How did you learn show business talk? I mean, did you just, like, pick all this up from watching TV, or did you actually talk this way with friends? Do you know what I mean? Just to... Were you into mocking this when you were younger?
I remember in 1962, I think, Jerry Lewis had a two-hour live talk show on ABC, and there was no ABC station carried per se up there in Thunder Bay, but some American stations we were able to get from cable, and one particular station was going to broadcast Jerry Lewis's show from 1 a.m. to 3 a.m. on Friday night. And I remember being a kid, you know, how old would I have been at that time, 15 or something, propping my eyes open at 2 in the morning and trying to stay awake because I was just fascinated with this stuff that these people would say and those tuxes that they would wear. I don't know why. It always struck me as funny. It wasn't until I did a show called Godspell, the Canadian company of the off-Broadway show in 72 and met some people in that show that are still my best friends, to include Martin Short, Dave Thomas, and Eugene Levy, the late Gilda Radner and Andrea Martin. All these Canadian kids were in this show, and for some reason, they shared the same kind of sense of humor about this stuff as I. We sort of crystallized it at that point, and as you said, used to talk that way as a joke among ourselves and pretend that we were in show business.
You know what I can never understand about this Toronto production of Godspell? Okay, everybody came from it. You, half the people from SCTV. And my memory of the score of Godspell is that it's this real ersatz rock gospel stuff.
Well, yeah, it was. That was the time for this kind of music, though.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ Superstar was right out at the same time. Think about that show Godspell, though. There was a lot of freedom in the script. What these kids were doing, actually, was interpreting comedically the parables from the New Testament. Doesn't sound that funny on paper, but they were allowed to put their own bits into the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Marty used to do, you know, the parable of the sheep as Betty Davis, and we would just be going hysterical.
Hmm. Martin Short is a good friend of yours.
Yeah.
Now, he's someone who has always been obsessed with show business, and he even spent his childhood singing along with Sinatra records and making up his own Martin Short version of the Perry Como show. Now, you grew up loving rock and roll, but at the same time getting kind of obsessed with show business, and really the two are so opposite. You know, and rock and roll was always the safe haven when your parents were watching the Dean Martin show. Did you always see these two interests of yours as being totally in conflict?
Yeah, I guess I did, but I sort of dedicated myself to showing that they really are the same. Are you saying that the Rolling Stones are not in show business?
Well, they are now.
Yeah. Even then, you know, their kind of show business was putting on a... I remember I heard an interview with a guy from Jay and the Americans one time, and he said that they opened for the Stones at Carnegie Hall. They couldn't believe it. They came off, they had just done a show, and here these guys come out in sweatshirts, and one guy doesn't move at all. But, you know, that was their scene. Kids were thrilled that a guy didn't have to put on a Jerry Lewis tux anymore.
I guess I'm trying to figure out if you liked show business for real when you were young, or if it was pure irony.
Well, it's been said that we all eventually become what we hate.
So you think you're becoming Mr. Showbiz for real?
Well, there is a part of me that loves this stuff, and there's a part of me that hates it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there's part of me that makes a living doing it, so how bad can it be, really?
You've even tried to bring together religion and show business. Can you tell us a little bit about your celebrity satyrs? I'm not sure if you still hold them or not.
Oh, I don't really. In the early days of Saturday Night Live, though, I used to conduct a Passover Seder for the kids, the performers and the staff, and those people who weren't going to be able to be with their families, and it kind of became known as the Paul Schaefer Celebrity Seder because I would do a kind of a show busy version of it, but still reverent. And, everybody was becoming a celebrity at that time. So, you know, I would say, I want to introduce, for the four questions, my favorite celebrity, Lorraine Newman. Lorraine, you have a movie coming out, don't you? And it was, you know, sort of half pattern, half show business.
Are you an observant Jew outside of your former celebrity Seders?
I wouldn't be able to say that about myself, no. I observe Passover, and I go to the synagogue once a year,
mm-hmm.
You know, like all the rest of us on the high holidays.
Mm-hmm.
But thank you, though.
You're always so ironic about being hip. I was wondering if you felt really square when you were growing up.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, again, I like to kid people that are hip, and what is hip, you know, and what's hip today will probably be passé. But it does, as a kid who really, you know, it was shy and didn't have much else to do but go and bash out rock and roll tunes on the piano after school.
So what made you feel square when you were young?
Just being so far away from what was happening and where they were making the records that I really wanted to be in on and be playing on and stuff like that. I was tightening my ski boots at the time, you know, lacing them up, and somebody else was, there was a rose in Spanish Harlem. Which would you rather be? You know, I was dying to be down there in Spanish Harlem. That's where I really wanted to be.
Paul Schaefer is my guest. You got your start on television as the pianist in the house band on Saturday Night Live. You weren't, I think, expected to be a performer who had lines or appeared in sketches. How did you start doing sketches?
Well, it was so frustrating to be on that show, to tell you the truth, to be in the band because the show was not about music at all. It was a comedy show. It was a, you know, cutting-edge comedy. And here I was in the band, just dying to get in on the action. The first thing I ever did, I think, as a performer was impression of Don Kirshner, the rock and roll promoter who had his own show at that time called Don Kirshner's Rock Concert. In the second season of Saturday Night Live, I took a year off and went to California and was briefly a sitcom actor, acting in a show called Year at the Top, which played in the summer of 77, a rock and roll sitcom, and Norman Lear and Don Kirshner were the producers. Well, the show was a flop, but it was not a total loss because I got down a perfectly accurate and I thought pretty funny impersonation of Kirshner. Luckily, when the show bombed, I got my old job back on Saturday Night Live, and there I was in season number 3 putting together a musical number for Garrett, which needed some kind of setup, and I just volunteered. I said, listen, I can do Don Kirshner. So I sort of, as they say, bogarted my way in and introduced that piece that week as Kirshner, and that was, you know, I started getting a few lines after that. And by the fifth season, I was actually billed as what they used to call a featured player, which is like a supporting actor on the show.
Did you miss Saturday Night Live when you left it?
Well, sure I did. Those Saturdays were very exciting, very long days. Band would come in at about 11:30 in the morning, and then, of course, the show would go on live 11:30 that night. So it was a long day, but an exciting day. I missed performing. I took refuge in the studios and spent 2 years as a studio musician, mm-hmm. where great kicks there, and making records is a lot of fun, but I missed getting to work in front of an audience. When I got that call from Letterman, it was great. I didn't know that this show would really be perfect for me, and the fact that I have a cute little band that plays in front of a studio audience every night, it's kind of like playing in a club. It's really nice.
When you put together the band for Letterman, what did you have in your mind for, you know, as far as the function that you wanted the band to play, the kind of statement, forgive me, that you wanted to make with the band?
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for calling it a statement. I had to answer that question when I was being interviewed by Letterman as producer for the job. They said, what kind of a band would you put together? And by the way, you can only have 4 guys because that's how much money we have. Well, that was perfect for me, the 4 guys, because I love to work with a small group. And I said to myself, well, the show's called Late Night. What if it is like a kind of an R&B quartet that you might see in a smoky late night lounge somewhere, as if that kind of place exists. I don't even know if whether it exists. But in Toronto, when I was in college, there was a topless club called the Zanzibar, where they had an organ nailed onto the bar, and different organ trios would slip in to place and play continuous music for these strippers all day long. And this, I thought, was the hippest thing in the world. I kind of patterned my band after that, the band at the Zanzibar. And when I told Letterman this concept, you know, we're a late-night lounge group that plays R&B, he says, well, I've always thought of myself as a Wayne Cochran anyway, so that sounds perfect for me. He related to it.
You know what I want to ask you? So many people in rock and roll have gotten really self-conscious about receding hairlines. A lot of musicians are wearing, like, sweatbands and hats and stuff like that just to cover it up, you
some,
know?
Some wear actual toupees.
Some wear actual toupees. Others
I don't want to list them right
implants.
Now.
Right, right. And I think you've been really hip about being, you know, having lost some of your hair, and that's it.
Well,
you know
this
I mean?
Is what exactly the word I would want a girl to use when talking about me. What are you going to do? You know, certainly you cannot get glue a thing onto your hair like some guys I know. You know, you can't. That's not hip. My dad used to. I think I got my hair growth pattern from him because he's pretty much completely bald. And he used to sit in front of the TV with me and say, oh, there's a good toupee, there's a hairpiece. He sort of trained me how to recognize them. So with training like that, you know, I'm certainly not going to glue one onto my own head.
My father used to do exactly the same thing.
So, I'll bet. I have a feeling your family's similar to mine.
So were you self-conscious, though, when you were younger and started to lose your hair? Was it a big deal for you?
Hair is always very important with kids, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
it certainly is important. Well, I had to figure out other ways of getting laid. Yeah. You know. And there are other ways, if, in case you were wondering.
I want to ask you about writing the late night theme for the Letterman show. Tell me about writing it. Tell me how you put it together.
Well, I was going for that sort of feeling that I was trying to explain before, but that the band was supposed to have a late night New York kind of thing. And I just got it in sections. You know, I thought about that opening first. Dun, 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 dun. So that sounds pretty good. I had that, you know. I only had about 3 days to write it, and I was kind of nervous because I hadn't written anything in a long time. But from there, you know, I figured, well, I could use that again at the end, and that's, I really only need a minute and a half here, so that's already, you know, 45 seconds. That's kind of how I wrote it.
Okay.
But I did write it, well, I knew that it was going to be played live every night. Somebody, originally, they wanted me to put it on tape, and I said, well, how can you start a show that's supposed to be live with tape music? We have to play it live every night. So that was one thing that I was conscious of while writing it, was I've got to leave it open for solos and improvisation, because I don't want it to get stale. And so every night, it's kind of a jam. It really only, there's about 7 bars of melody at the beginning that the organ plays, and after that, it's just a jam. That's why, hopefully, we're not, you know, we don't get sick of playing it every night, because we play it, you know, 4 times a week.
Right. Well, you have a version of it on your new record, Coast to Coast.
Yeah.
So we'll close out with some of that. I want to thank you, Paul Schaefer, a lot for talking with
us. I've had the time of my life, and I never felt like this before, if I may quote Bill Medley. Thank you very much. It has been fun, though. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for doing it.